Hello, and welcome to the podcast by Future Observatory, the Design Museum's research program supporting the green transition. I'm Justin McGurk, the director of Future Observatory.
And I'm Sher Potter, Future Observatory's curatorial director. In this podcast, we'll be introducing you to design researchers who've put issues of climate and the environment at the heart of their practice. These researchers work across a range of disciplines, but all of their investigations have major implications for how we design the world. So Justin, what comes to mind if I say the word upcycling?
To be honest, I've always been slightly sceptical because upcycling conjures a kind of Mad Max-style future scavenged from our leftovers of tin cans turned into lampshades. But I think I was wrong because when it works, it's much more energy efficient than recycling. So for me, it depends very much on the waste stream and the resulting product.
Upcycling is also sometimes referred to as creative reuse or creative manufacture, and it is just that. Design is transforming byproducts into new products or parts of new products. It taps the design process into waste streams that could include anything from leather skin from sofas, hardwood plates of wardrobes, or rubber tires from vehicle repair stores.
The UK produces over 200 million tons of waste a year. And at the moment, about a quarter of that is sent to landfill. Surely a lot of that material will have a reuse value.
Exactly, that's right. And some estimates suggest as much as 80% of waste could be reused and otherwise diverted from landfill sites. We're all familiar with upcycled timber used in furniture, and there have been some surprising, although still elementary, developments in the luxury market in the past few years, with fashion houses like Miu Miu and Balenciaga producing capsule collections refashioned from discarded clothing or even shoelace fur. To hear more from one of our forerunners in producing luxury from landfill, I travelled to the farmyard, yes, that's right, the farmyard rather than the studio, of Elvis and Cressy. They're working with a very specific waste stream, one you've probably never thought about, old fire hoses.
Hi, I'm Elvis from Elvis and Cressy, one of the co-founders. Elvis is not my real name, it's a nickname, real name James. And we are standing at New Barns Farm, which is the headquarters, a little bit lofty perhaps, of Elvis and Cressy. And we're standing outside on a beautiful sunny day, and we're going to tell you all about the things that we do here.
This is compost tea.
We make our own compost, and if you were to lay the compost directly out into the field, you'd need...
You might be wondering what a very noble-sounding project to create a sustainable farm, with all of its complexities, has to do with handbags and with design. But as I walk to one of the sheds, I see piles of something, loops snaking around into coils and stacked high, some with stamps identifying them.
So we're standing in front of a pile of fire hoses. There must be about, I would imagine, 100, 150 rolled-up fire hoses, red and yellow, primarily in colour, still with their kind of attachments, metal attachments.
Couplings.
Still with their couplings attached to the end of the pipes. Completely undeconstructed at this point.
Yeah, so this is exactly how it arrives. We haven't done any of our processes whatsoever. But you can see, I'll lift one off and you can see how heavy they are.
Oh yeah, that's pretty substantial, yeah. Isn't it?
This is how it comes, so it's dirty, both on the outside and on the inside. So we actually then...
At that moment, Cressy, the other half of the brand Elvis and Cressy, comes to join us.
What have you guys seen so far?
These fire hoses, which could have ended in landfill, are actually the material for this designer's handbags. They're made here, the handbags that is, in a tiny workshop on the farm.
This is Danny, he's our chief craftsman.
Hiya.
And right now he's operating a laser. So we use this laser to both cut out pieces, and I think, are you cutting out a wristband?
Yeah, enough to cut.
So for a lot of companies, if you're using leather goods, you would have a heat stamp to deboss the leather. But because fire hose is heat resistant, debossing doesn't work.
Cressy, it would be great to hear more, you know, how the idea came to you to, first of all, find decommissioned fire hoses, and second of all, turn them into luxury accessories.
I moved to the UK in 2004, and I have always been completely obsessed with waste. So day one, I went to the sewers. Day two, I went to the waste transfer station at Battersea, which is now no more because it's very expensive housing there. And then day three, I went to the British Library because they've got a business and IP center where you can find out pretty much everything that you want to know about waste. So I went to see these incredible landfill sites following that research in order to just try and understand why we were wasting so much. I expected landfill sites to be complete chaos and just those black burst bin bags filled with nappies and tennis rackets. And actually, there was truck after truck after truck bringing in these incredible mono wastes that were clean, that had never been used. We talk about single-use plastic now, but there was never seen the light of day plastics coming in. And the best way to find these materials in a usable form was to actually chase the truck drivers and find out where they came from. And what I worked my way through was back to industrial estates, which are a treasure trove of all of these kinds of materials that have never been used, hardly been used, like tea sack and coffee sack. I found both of those at industrial estates. But the fire hose, I saw one in a landfill and I thought, gosh, why is that there? And I had this absolutely ridiculous chance meeting with the London Fire Brigade. I was doing a course in ISO 14001, like learning how to be an environmental auditor, because that's kind of cool kid I was in my early 20s. And there was two guys from London Fire Brigade on the same course. And I said, why do your hoses go to landfill? And they explained that in a good year, London will decommission 3 tons of hose. And that's because those hoses have reached the end of their 25-year health and safety life. But in a bad year, they can be decommissioning up to 10 tons of hose.
And so at what point were you struck by the idea that these hoses could become handbags? Because you don't come from a design background, do you?
No. And that was down to Elvis, really, because I thought they would make fantastic roof tiles. When you look at the information about a fire hose, when it's not actually a hose with water running through it, it's not fireproof anymore. And if you put it on a roof and expose it to UV for 10 years, it will crack and it will leak. So if I'd gone into the roofing business, it would have been a disaster. So there was a lot of research, again, back at the British Library around what is nitrile rubber, what can it do? Went to Yorkshire, where fire hose is made, learned everything that we could about it. And then we started going into various industry areas and looking at who was researching nitrile rubber, who was using nitrile rubber, what were they using it for? What are its heating point, its melting point? And at about the same time that I found this document showing that a couple of French luxury brands have been using nitrile rubber since the advent of complex polymers, I also found a report on the state of the luxury industry, where the World Wildlife Fund had commissioned a report looking into whether, well, basically what the social and ethical performance of the luxury industry was. And it was scoring at the max a C. I think L'Oreal was getting a C. And I just thought, well, here's an industry that structurally failed. So I had two things. I had this beautiful raw material that I knew would work for luxury. And I had an industry that I looked at as a big fat failure because it wasn't doing anything for people and it wasn't doing anything for the planet. And I was so naive that the thought that ran through my mind was, how hard can it be to compete with a dead French luggage maker? That was really the thought that came to my mind. It was so naive and so crazy. I had no idea how big some of these companies were. I had no idea how the industry was structured with, you know, this complete French dominance. I had no idea how stratified and no idea like that, and no design background. And I think actually that was a gift, because we had no rules. We didn't care about anything other than the fire hose itself and making a world-class business that was great for people and planet.
And so your first step was to set up a studio in London.
Well, I think studio's a bit grand. We had a rivet press next to our bed in our house share in Brixton, and that's where Elvis made our first ever set of belts. We started with belts because fire hose is long and straight, and belts are long and straight, and neither of us knew how to sew. When we sold enough belts, we bought a sewing machine. Actually, the first sewing machine we bought broke. And we went through 4 machines before we finally got our first Toyota, which took 4 people to carry. And that one worked for the fire hose. So Elvis then learned how to make bags. Whatever skills that we require, he will acquire them. And meanwhile, I was out selling these things.
That's fascinating. So you began by coming into the fashion industry, not really as a designer, but as someone who wanted to challenge a system. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you've moved out of London, into the countryside, with the idea of doing that on a much larger scale, right?
Yes.
Questioning this idea of how can a design studio exist, not in an urban space, but in a space within a natural ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about about the questions that drove you to move here and what it is that you're discovering in terms of how a design space exists within a natural ecosystem.
I think more designers need to leave their urban environments and get their hands dirty. We came here because there are two big existential threats facing civilization, right? It's climate change and biodiversity loss. And I think those are incredibly difficult to challenge with your own two hands in an urban environment. Even in our previous building, which was not super urban or super rural, it was a listed building, so we couldn't put any solar panels on the roof. We didn't have enough land to do funky wastewater treatment like we're doing here. And we knew instinctively that a farm where we could also challenge the failing food system would be quite fascinating. Then we went on this search. This started about 3 or 4 years ago, to find a farm. When we finally found this place, it's called New Barns Farm, but it should have been called horrible Old Barns Farm because everything was in complete state. We knew it was perfect for us because we love a pile of rubbish, and that's what this place was essentially. The soil was compacted, terrible condition, no earthworms, very little organic content in the soil. And when we started to look into the food system, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, we thought that maybe we could say something interesting about that. We also always wanted our workshop to be in a beautiful place. You know, the idea of being in an industrial estate never appealed to us. And if you put what you do in an ecosystem, you're bound to want to protect that ecosystem and beyond. You want to challenge everything about how things are working or aren't working in the countryside. And what we found since we've been here is, I've always had a deep respect for farmers. My grandparents were farmers in Saskatchewan and Canada. You know, it is an unbelievably challenging industry. You're at the mercy of the weather. Food has been way too cheap for way too long, in the same way that fashion has. So I've always understood that about the fashion system. I've always thought it was appalling that you could get a £2.50 t-shirt, knowing what has to go into that. And I now understand why it's appalling to get a 10p cucumber, because try growing a cucumber. It's actually really difficult to grow a cucumber that isn't filled with bugs and worms, or that you haven't coated in so many hideous chemicals that you yourself are wearing a hazmat suit when you go out into the natural environment. So here we are on this farm. Of course, we're doing regenerative agriculture, which is beyond organic and beyond biodynamic. We are not using any sprays at all, except for compost tea, which is a tea we brew from the compost we manufacture at the bottom of the farm. We also practice holistic plant grazing, so we have a small flock of sheep. The reason we planted vines here is because when we came and we did the soil studies, that's what you could grow here. But why is it important to be on a farm? It's because we need to survive the same things as plants. You know, we need water, we need sunshine, and we need food. And if you don't have a deep understanding of that and a love for it, I think it makes it harder to challenge the status quo. This place and how we run this place, much in the same way that Elvis and Cressy gave us the platform to challenge what I see as a failed industry, this farm gives us a chance to challenge the food industry and to show that maybe a different thing can be done. And why is design important? Because I'm not thinking about product design. I'm thinking about systems that need to be totally overhauled. And we don't have all the answers, but by putting ourselves in this rural community amidst a treasure trove of other farmers who all want to learn, who all want to share their expertise, you know, we're in an amazing space to be able to participate in this burgeoning dialogue around regenerative agriculture and the future of food.
I mean, do you feel as though you're prototyping a new environment for design to work in? I mean, what do you see as the potential kind of scale-up of what you're doing?
Scale-up might not happen for us. You know, Elvis and I for sure are not empire builders. We are problem solvers. And I think that's the biggest thing that I want designers to go out and do. We get calls all the time of people going, oh, I'd love to sort of do what you guys do, but in New Jersey. And I say, well, what are the problems in New Jersey? What do you find in your landfill site in New Jersey? Go out into your ecosystem and see what's wrong, and then turn that into a creative business. Could be a components business. It could be a tech business. Not all of these things have to scale, but they all have to be, I guess, fronted and then fostered by people who are lifelong committed to, you know, saving our butts as a civilization, and then people who also can assemble teams of talented, wonderful people to help them achieve those missions and ambitions.
and then to the finished product.
Ah, so this is one of our fire and hide pieces. So you've got fire hose trim, and then the body of the bag is made from rescued Burberry leather. And that comes in whatever colours we get from Burberry. When we first started the company, we had a list of 11 shapes, not of trendy hot season items, but we went to a lot of the department stores, and this is really not designery about us. We said, what do people use perennially, year in, year out? And so the next bag here is a bucket tote. And this was number one on our list to make. Every brand makes a bag that looks like this. And the reason they make a bag that looks like this is because people carry them. And it's a ubiquitous design. The tote bag in Firehose Red is our best-selling piece by a country mile. This one in particular is made from yellow hose trim and black printing blanket, which is another waste material that we take. It's a waste from the offset printing industry. So we never wanted to go crazy with shapes and be trendy with shapes. We want to make pieces that you want to use year in, year out, and will last for a really long time.
For me, Elvis and Cressy are responding to one of the major problems with industrialization, which is that waste is thought about as a marginal issue, treated as an unavoidable byproduct. But if waste could be a central issue, brought into the very heart of every conversation about how things are sourced, designed, and disposed of, it could transform society.
Well, that's exactly right. Elvis and Cressy have, in a way, reinvented themselves, not only as designers, but as material researchers and waste stream investigators. Their beautiful luxury bags speak about the opaque systems of waste disposal and the afterlife of landfill materials. It's this kind of design thinking that's absolutely essential, really, for reducing waste.
I'm also intrigued by the way they've chosen to live on a regenerative farm and to base their practice there. It's an attempt to create a holistic practice from within a holistic lifestyle.
Which is reinforced by their ambivalence about scaling up.
Absolutely. Instead of thinking along conventional lines of, quote, scaling up, they're interested in growth only if it's regenerative growth, which is a potentially revolutionary way of thinking about business and economics.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Future Observatory's podcast. Don't forget to sign up to our monthly newsletter at futureobservatory.org.
This podcast is supported by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, part of UK Research and Innovation, and the Design Museum. The producers are Marie Keyworth and Sarah Trina, and the music is by Takahisa Mitsumori.